Hello, I'm Dr. Michelle Buckley from Iowa State University's College of Veterinary Medicine. Thanks so much for joining us on Baws and Bleats, sponsored by the American Association of Small Ruminant Practitioners. Just a quick note before we get started, this work is also supported by the USDA National Institute of Food and Agriculture Agricultural and Food Research Initiative Competitive Program Antimicrobial Resistance Grant Number 2020-04197, which funds my research on improving antibiotic stewardship in dairy goats to assure food safety and milk quality. As always, if you have any questions about any of our episodes, please email them to dairygoatextension@iastate.edu. I hope you enjoy today's show. And thanks for joining us today on season one of the American Association of Small Ruminant Practitioners podcast. This season, we're focusing on improving milk quality and food safety in dairy goats. And today we have Dr. Virginia Fate joining us to talk about how to use drugs safely in dairy goats. Thanks for joining us, Dr. Fate. Can you give us a bit of background information on yourself to get started?
Sure. Hi there. My name is Virginia Fate, and I'm a veterinarian and a clinical pharmacologist. I work at Texas A&M University, and I've been involved in teaching pharmacology to veterinary students as well as other undergraduates and graduate students. I collaborate with clinical faculty here at Texas A&M on various kinds of research projects related to drugs in animals, particularly in food-producing animals. I went to veterinary school at Auburn. I didn't grow up on a farm. I grew up in kind of a rural area. And I got interested in sheep and goats, actually, before I went to vet school, and continued that interest through vet school. I did a food animal internship at Kansas State University. I was a clinician there for a year. And then I did graduate work in clinical pharmacology, antibiotics in cattle. And so I've been interested in food producing animals throughout my veterinary career. One of the things that clinical pharmacologists sometimes focus on is the regulatory aspects of drug use, drug approval, legal and illegal drug use, choosing drugs, making decisions about drugs, antibiotics, antibiotic resistance, and those kinds of things are some of the things that I've been interested in.
Awesome. I think we have a very similar, we've been on a very similar path, or at least mine starting out kind of like yours did. So I hope I can be as helpful as you are. So I guess as a clinical pharmacologist, you're the perfect person to talk to in helping other practitioners make wise choices in how to choose which drug they need when they're dealing with a specific problem. So what's kind of a good process or thought process to go through when deciding which drug to use once we've diagnosed a problem? And then how would that maybe be different for goats as a minor species versus cattle as a major species?
Yeah, there's a lot wrapped up in there. One of the things that that I like to think about when as veterinarians are making decisions about drugs is a systematic approach to making choices about drugs, antibiotics, or any other type of drug, and starting out thinking like, what is my therapeutic goal? What is it that I'm trying to accomplish with this drug? Obviously, that's going to stem from whatever you diagnose the problem is, or even if it's symptomatic sort of treatment. And if it's an antibiotic, one of your first questions should be, do I know what bacteria are likely to be present in this infection? Do I know which drugs are likely to be effective against that type of bacteria? Do I know that the drug will actually get to the site of the infection? This becomes really important when you talk about, for example, dairy goats and mastitis. Mastitis causes issues because we're the concentrations of drugs in the udder are different than they are in other parts of the body. They're not necessarily correlated directly with plasma concentrations or tissue concentrations. And so it's just another piece of information you need to think about if you're approaching, in particular, mastitis. And the thing about food animals is you're always layering on the decision-making about which drug to use. You're layering on, are there restrictions, whether they're federal restrictions or restrictions related to the product consumer or the buyer of your product. So a dairy or a creamery or a dairy along those lines, you're going to want to be thinking about not just does this drug work, is it effective in the animal, but is it legal and is it likely to cause a problem that relates to public health? And that's where most of the drug regulations come from. They relate to safety in humans. So some of the challenges with working with food animals, particularly small ruminants, is that many of those animals are not considered food producing animals by their owners, or they are kind of cross purpose, right? They're food animals, they're milk goats, but they're also, they have names. You know, they're more like pets. But in the eyes of the law, in the eyes of the USDA, the FDA, the milk producer co-ops and so on, those are food producing animals. And so the laws that apply to other food producing animals apply to goats, regardless of the intention of the producer or the owner as to what's going to happen to those goats at the end of their lives. So it's important to recognize that it doesn't matter that they're a minor, so-called minor species. You mentioned major species versus minor species. That's a definition. That's a federal regulatory definition that has to do with the number of animals there are and their importance in the food supply and in the populations in the country. So the major food producing animals are cattle, swine, chickens, and turkeys. And so sheep and goats are minor species, but essentially all of the laws apply to them. There are a couple of minor differences one minor difference in one regulation, but generally speaking, goats are food animals. And so any of the regulations that say anything about food producing animals and restrictions on drug use apply to goats, regardless of their lifestyle or what their goals are in life. So,
okay. So we first need to diagnose the problem as veterinarians, and then we need to consider what drug we can use based on the regulations that's going to accomplish our therapeutic goal. And sometimes those regulations can get a little bit sticky, but that's where folks like you and I come in. Well, hopefully me someday, if I can ever get through boards. There's always clinical pharmacologists out there, right? Ready to chat with practitioners that might have questions about this type of thing. Do you deal with that a lot?
Yeah. And there are a number of clinical pharmacologists that, that kind of focus on food producing animals. Veterinary practitioners who pay attention and who are going to their continuing education and have their, keep up with what's happening in the profession should also be familiar with those rules and regulations. Hopefully they learned about them in school or in their, postgraduate training or mentoring, or the continuing education hours that they get. All of the food animal veterinarians that I know that are clinical veterinarians, like internists and surgeons who work at veterinary teaching hospitals, are all familiar with these regulations and so kind of help veterinary students learn how to make those decisions appropriately. So a couple of colleagues of mine, other clinical pharmacologists, Dr. Brian Lubers and Mike Apley at Kansas State, I've heard them say the questions you should be asking yourself when you're thinking about using a drug in food producing animal is it legal? Is it effective? And is it safe? And so that legal question, oftentimes, when you're thinking about a food producing animal, you might as well start there, because if it's not legal, it doesn't matter if it's effective or safe, right? So effective, that fits with what we were talking about before, which is, does it address the therapeutic goal that I'm interested in addressing? And then safe is about safety of the animal. So We want to make sure that there aren't significant adverse effects that might be important in a particular animal. And then, is it safe to consume products from that animal, or when does it become safe? And I think maybe that's what you want to talk about next, which is, what does that mean? That leads to what many producers are familiar with, and veterinarians certainly are familiar with, which is withdrawal times. So the withdrawal time is the time after a drug is administered that you must prevent the product, whether it's milk or meat, from entering the food supply. So we talk about milk withdrawal times or meat withdrawal times. So depending on what product you're talking about, in the case of, you know, dairy goats, you'd be talking about milk in particular. How long do I need to withhold the milk from that animal after I use a drug? That's the withdrawal time. Withdrawal times are for drugs that are approved for a particular use and in a particular species of animal at a specific regimen, and that becomes really important. So regimen is the dose of drug, milligrams per kilogram or something along those lines. The route that I'm administering the drug, am I giving it intravenously, intramuscularly, intramammary? The frequency, am I giving it once or twice a day or four times a day? And then duration is, how long am I giving it? Am I giving this once? Am I giving it for 5 days and so on? So dose, route, frequency, duration, that's what makes up the regimen. And so the regimen becomes really important for withdrawal time, because the regimen determines how much drug is in the animal for how long. And that that will have an impact on how long that the products from that animal need to stay out of the food supply. And depending on whether it's milk or meat, there are different ways of determining it. But those are experimental methods that happen for a drug that's approved. Those studies would be performed prior to the drug being made available for purchase. And the regimen that's on the label would be administered to a group of animals, and then samples would be taken over a period of time. Some mathematical and statistical models would be used to determine at a particular confidence interval for a 99% of the population when the concentration of drug in the product is below a particular amount. And that particular amount is called a tolerance. And so that's actually a legal term. So tolerance, and tolerance is determined by a much more complicated methodology that I don't, but yeah, if we have show notes, we can give you a link to that. But the tolerance has to do with an acceptable amount that a human could consume over, you know, a period of time and be safe. Because when you administer a drug to an animal, there are always going to be a few molecules of drug left. And those at below particular concentrations, those amounts are going to be safe. The dose makes the poison, as Paracelsus said many millennia ago. And so it's possible to have a very low amounts of drug that are completely safe and safe to be consumed. And that's what a tolerance is all about. And so what we're trying to establish is, with some confidence, if I treat any animal that's on the drug label with the regimen that's on the label, how long do I need to wait? And with confidence, when I put that product into the food supply, will it be safe because it doesn't have drug above the tolerance?
My boss, Dr. Gordon, loves to give the example that if, you know, you handed someone a $20 bill and then had them do a drug test, the sensitivity of these tests that we're talking about that we're using on animals would allow you to detect cocaine in that person's system just because they handled the $20 bill. They're obviously not under the influence of that drug, but it's just, we are able to get so sensitive. But you can handle cash your whole life and not have ramifications from cocaine usage. So just to kind of give people a real world example, maybe that's a little more relatable. Have you heard that one before from Dr. Gordon?
Yeah, that's a great one. You know, the ping pong ball in the swimming pool, right? I mean, the grain of sand really in the swimming pool. So the sensitivity, the accuracy of the tests can detect parts per million, parts per billion, parts per quadrillion. And just because we can detect a small number of molecules of drug doesn't mean that that drug is at any concentration that will have any effect in an animal or any effect in a person that consumes the product.
because it's low enough levels that just because it's detectable doesn't mean it's not safe. And so that's a really important point. No, there will never be zero drug when you administer a drug to an animal, but it will be below any level that's actionable or unsafe for human consumption if the withdrawal time is followed appropriately. So a withdrawal time is established for drugs that are approved by the FDA, Center for Veterinary Medicine, and the withdrawal time is on the label. So if you are using a drug exactly as what's on the label, then you can follow the labeled withdrawal time. The challenge with any species, but particular with goats, is that there really aren't that many products that are approved for use in goats. And so oftentimes veterinarians are selecting drugs that are approved in other species of animal. Or maybe they're approved for goats, but they're approved for a different indication, a different disease. And so when you use a drug in a fashion that's called extra label, then you have to think differently about withdrawal time. So defining extra label, it's a very simple definition. It's using the drug in any way that's not on the label. So if the drug is labeled for intramuscular use and you administer it subcutaneously, that's extra label. If the dose on the label says 5 mg/kg and you give it 10 mg/kg, that's extra label. If the drug is approved for cattle and you use it in goats, that's extra label. So it's anything that's not on the label is considered extra label. Now, there are lots of ways to be extra label. There's the, it's approved in goats and I'm going to use it for a slightly different indication, or it's approved in dogs and I'm going to use it in a goat. All of those things are extra label, but there are differences in terms of how we interpret whether that's a legal extra label use or not. So we'll get to that a little bit later, but it does become challenging, you know, sometimes to interpret, what extra label means. But the point about extra label and withdrawal time is if you use a drug in an extra label manner, then the withdrawal time that was on the label doesn't apply anymore. And so you need to gather information. And luckily in the United States and some other countries, we have access to FARAD, the Food Animal Residue Avoidance Databank, that's supported by your tax dollars, but it's a USDA supported project. At several universities that over the last 30 years have developed a database of information about the pharmacology and pharmacokinetics of drugs and pesticides and other compounds that animals can be exposed to, food animals can be exposed to. And so if you are going to use a drug in an extra label manner in a food producing animal, you can contact FARAD to see if they can help you estimate what the withdrawal time should be. So they use their extensive knowledge, their proprietary database, their algorithms for statistical analysis of pharmacokinetic data to say, all right, so this drug is approved in cattle and you want to use it in a goat. Here's what we know about how this drug works in goats. Here's what we know about the pharmacokinetics in goats, the drug disposition, concentrations over time, et cetera. And therefore, we think that our best scientific estimate is that the withdrawal time in a goat for this should be 45 days, whereas, say, in cattle, it might be 30 days. So extended withdrawal time is typically what FARAD will provide a veterinarian with. So that's the important thing about FARAD is their job is to help veterinarians make good decisions or manage situations where there's an inadvertent exposure of a food producing animal to some product. So a lot of veterinarians think about FARAD as about drugs, but they also will help you manage, for example, if a group of animals got into an agricultural chemical, for example, and you'd like to know, when might I be able to market these animals? And sometimes FARAD will have information that they can help you essentially establish a withdrawal time for whatever that chemical is. You wouldn't typically do that, but it's a toxicity situation as opposed to a therapeutic situation.
Essentially, if it's not on the box, you need to ask FARAD, and FARAD should be able to give you some guidance based on the research that they have accumulated and that postdoc students like myself are doing and things like that. So even if drugs aren't labeled for something, it may still be an option. You just need to ask. If something happens accidentally, you like, we can, you know, we gave ivermectin to a lactating dairy cow. Oh man, well, what do? You need to call FARAD and they can help you sort it out.
Yeah, that's right. I think the other thing I would say about contacting FARAD about withdrawal times is if you contacted them 10 years ago and got an extended withdrawal time for a regimen that you use fairly often, you should call them regularly because over time research accumulates, we get better information. The tests that are used to detect drugs change as well, maybe become more sensitive. The Food Safety and Inspection Service may revise the way that what they test for, how they test, when they test. And so things change over time. So those withdrawal time estimates that come from FARAD shouldn't be thought of as static. They could potentially change over time. They might get shorter. They might get longer. They might, some people I've had the experience where they contact FARAD and FARAD says, we can't give you a withdrawal time that will keep this product safe. And we recommend that you don't use that drug in that animal because for a number of reasons, pharmacology there and legal ramifications.
And I definitely have heard FARAD employees say these are not meant to be used in protocols or anything like that. These are a case by case recommendation because they can be updated so frequently. So that's a good point to highlight. To kind of move a little bit away from FARAD, I know there's a list of drugs there's a list of regulations, right, that govern how we use drugs in food animals specifically. And on that list, there are a few drugs that we absolutely cannot use in food animals or in lactating animals. So can you just kind of name those off for me real quick, just so they're on people's radar if you're going to start working with dairy goats?
Yeah. So let's clarify first of all. So the federal regulations that govern extra label drug use in food producing, well, extra label drug use in general, and then specifically the section of that that applies to food producing animals, describes drugs that cannot be used in an extra label manner in food producing animals. And so that's kind of a key phrase, is that in an extra label manner. Because there are some drugs on that list that are labeled for some food producing animals, but they would be illegal for use in other food producing animals. So it's a good example about goats, which is that the drug Baytrol, that contains the fluoroquinolone and rofloxacin, there is a formulation of that that's approved in cattle for respiratory disease. But fluoroquinolones cannot be used extra label in food producing animals. So that drug cannot be used in a food animal that's not on the label. So that drug cannot be used in goats, for example, because they are considered a food producing animal and it is not on the label. But it can be used in cattle if you use it as what's on the label. So it's a little bit of a, I wouldn't say confusing, but it's sort of a fine point that we say never use enrofloxacin in goats, but it's because you can't use them extra label and there are no labeled enrofloxacin products for goats. So effectively, it's illegal to use them in goats, but it's the extra label use that's technically the illegal piece of it. So it's a little bit of a, I know I sound like a lawyer, right? So, but that is the case, right? So drugs that are illegal for extra label use in food producing animals, which would include goats, include things like clenbuterol, dimetrodazole, metronidazole, nitrofurazone, furazolidone, the fluoroquinolone antibiotics, so enrofloxacin, ciprofloxacin, difloxacin, the glycopeptides, vancomycin is the main one that some people might have heard of. It's a human used drug, usually mostly used in humans, but it's in the category of glycopeptides. So not that anyone would probably use those in a food producing animal, but it would be illegal to do that. Yeah. It's expensive. It's hard to administer, you know, et cetera. Sulfonamides can't be used extra label in dairy cows, lactating dairy cows. So some people think that it maybe is a sort of higher regulatory priority when it comes to extra label uses in other dairy animals, so dairy goats, but technically it's not illegal to use them extra label in dairy goats. It's only illegal to use them extra label in dairy cows. But to me, that would suggest that maybe you should be cautious when you're doing that. The other one that's illegal for extra label use in dairy animals is a non-steroidal anti-inflammatory, phenylbutazone. Some of you may be familiar with its use in horses, but that's illegal for use in lactating dairy cows as well. So that's another one that, you know, if I was trying to be cautious, I would use a different NSAID if I was interested in using one in a dairy goat. The one that is a little bit confusing is, particularly when it comes to small ruminants, is the extra label use of cephalosporins. So there is a, cephalosporins are included on the list of extra label uses that are illegal, but it's kind of a fine-tuned illegal. So extra label use of cefepirin, which is a mastitis product, is not illegal. It's okay to use cefepirin extra label. So that means you can use it in dairy cows in a regimen that's different than what's on the label. And it also means you can use it in dairy goats. The other thing about the cephalosporin extra label use ban is that it doesn't apply to minor species. So it doesn't apply. It only applies to cattle and swine and poultry. It doesn't apply to sheep and goats. And so drugs like ceftiofur, which is a cephalosporin, are not illegal to use in goats. Even though it sounds like there's a ban on extra label use of cephalosporins, there is in major species of food producing animals, which are cattle, swine, chickens, and turkeys. So we kind of have a nice little loophole there when it comes to small ruminants that we don't have in other places, and which is useful because there aren't a lot of drugs that are approved. So we are doing a lot of extra label use in some cases for some things because their drugs are just not approved for those small ruminants. The best approach, if you're a veterinarian, is to contact FARAD before you choose a drug. And if you are, if for some reason a use occurs that you might not have chosen yourself or that another veterinarian chose or there's an inadvertent exposure, somebody makes a mistake, that's a really good time to call FARAD to find out what the best withdrawal time would be for, even if it's an illegal, it turns out to be an illegal use. Getting that information for FARAD will really help you when it comes to having the conversation with the producer or the state board or whatever it is to say, well, I did the best I could. There was an inadvertent exposure. I got information from FARAD. We withheld the animal for this prolonged period of time. And so we've managed the situation.
Awesome. I think it's important to remember that you're not bothering FARAD. If you contacted them, you know, multiple times a week and you're trying to do the right thing and you're new to dairy goats or just working on food animals and you just want to make sure you're doing the right thing, you're not bothering them. It's their job. They love doing it. And they want to help educate people. So it's never the wrong choice to call them.
That is an excellent point. Yeah. I mean, they have highly trained individuals that answer phones and hear questions, and there are questions that they get regularly that then they have access to that information that they've given out before. And so they're not necessarily starting new with every single question that comes across. If you're not sure, contacting them is definitely the best approach. And in most cases, they will get back to you very quickly. So, you're not going to call them and get an answer on the phone, and they would prefer anyway that you email or go on to the website to contact them. But generally it'll be, you know, within a day or two that you'll have the answer that you need. So yeah, it's never wrong to contact them.
So, and then if something inadvertent happens, a drug that was given you know, that you didn't recommend, or was, you know, the selection was incorrect and you realize it after the fact, your license isn't going to just automatically explode, right? Like there are some things that we can do to mitigate that getting into the food supply. But what happens if a drug is given illegally, or we do something that we shouldn't? What are the ramifications? What's the worst case possibility? And what does that mean for that animal and for our license and our producers?
Well, yeah. So let's say you don't know about it, or maybe somebody misreads the label and sends an animal to the harvest facility, or they send milk to the milk producer, to the creamery or whatever, without knowledge of that the withdrawal time wasn't followed, or something else happened, or there was a drug exposure that wasn't recorded properly, then those facilities, those food producing facilities, whether they're slaughter plants or or milk producers, creameries, and so on, milk processors, they will routinely test with milk. Every tanker of milk is tested. With meat, it's a statistically random sampling that's performed of samples of carcasses to test for multiple drugs. And so depending on whether you're talking about milk or meat, for milk, essentially every tanker full of milk is tested for particularly for antibiotics. But it's essentially all milk gets tested in the United States if it's going to a commercial processor. Now, if you're milking at home, or you're milking for a co-op or something like that, or for a small, what do they call those, cooperatives, producer, small groups of, then that might not be tested. And so that's a separate conversation about where do you get your milk from, as to whether that's, but the commercial milk that you buy at the store, every tanker full is going to be tested for drugs. And for meat, a statistically random sample of carcasses will be tested, along with carcasses, if they look unusual to the inspector in the slaughter plant, if there are obvious injection site reactions, or if the animal has some appearance of, if the animal looks like they're sick, they won't ever go into the food supply at all. But they also might then get tested to see if they also have residues, but grossly contaminated meat doesn't enter the food supply at all. But if there's some suspicion about, that an animal looks like they might have recently had an illness, they would be set aside, tested separately. The carcass wouldn't enter the food supply until the test results came back, and so on. And so that's how those are the ways that our food supply is protected from. It's the end of the veterinarian makes a good choice about using drugs, follows regulations. They use drugs that are approved in the species or in some other species of animal or people for that matter. So they use approved products. They follow withdrawal times or get extended withdrawal times from FARAD. And then the last sort of pillar is the sampling at harvest time. So there's a whole series of events that all together help protect the food supply, so we have safe, wholesome product in the end.
And it's the USDA that supervises the monitoring, right, in slaughter plants and the testing facilities with the dairy. And those are USDA trained inspectors and veterinarians that are at every processing plant that sells food to the general public, right?
Yeah, that's right. So the only if you are not purchasing commercially manufactured products, that's where the sort of the last pillar might not. If you're drinking milk from your own animals, obviously that's not happening. And so make sure that other things are happening appropriately, that you're working with a veterinarian to make good choices about drugs, that you're not consuming the milk when there might be drugs in the milk, that you follow a withdrawal time. You're just not selling the milk, you're consuming it. So yeah, those, so that, that last, you know, gateway of protection isn't there, but it, but all the other protections are there. And there are ways for, individual, they're not approved for those ways, but there are methods of testing product to try to see if there are contaminants, if there are a drug, enough drug left in there to cause a problem. So,
yeah, that's a good point. And I know I've heard some, especially dairy practitioners that I've been around, will recommend that their clients actually test the milk in their bulk tank, before they ship it, or they'll test their hospital string or animals from their hospital string. They'll dilute samples from those animals, test them with an on-site milk test to make sure that they're clear before they get put back in the milking string, to make sure that we don't have any contaminated product going to the processing plant. And obviously, with more of a dairy background, I know a lot about the milk, but how about the meat side? Is there like an equivalent on-site test that you can do to evaluate meat residues?
There are some people that that have used or advocated the use of testing methodologies where you would test urine to look for drug concentrations. The challenge with that is, I mean, it's an interesting approach because you're addressing the problem before it becomes a problem, right? You're trying to identify animals that might, you know, test hot if they go to a slaughterhouse. But those, the drug concentrations in urine don't exactly mirror drug concentrations in the rest of the animal. And that has to do with physiology and the way urine is produced and so on, which is beyond the scope of this discussion right here. But urine concentrations don't correlate exactly with tissue concentrations. They don't correlate exactly with muscle or meat concentrations. So if you test a sample of urine and there happens to be a detectable amount of drug in it, it may be that there actually isn't enough drug in the tissues to be a problem. We just don't have, we have some information. There's some scientific information about the pharmacokinetics and urine concentrations and so on. But the urine concentration can be so variable, it's challenging to trace it back to how much is actually in the tissues of interest in the animal. If we know what's happening in the urine, there's a pretty wide range of possibilities of what could also be happening in tissue. So it's one approach. In some ways, it's a conservative approach, right? If there's any in the urine, there might be some in the animal. But it's also possible that even if there's some in the urine, there might not be a detectable amount in the meat. And so it's an approach that people use and sometimes use successfully, particularly on a group level, right? Maybe you're not trying to identify a specific animal. Maybe something happened and there was some sort of inadvertent exposure. So now you're trying to figure out when is the best time to harvest those animals. I don't think they're commonly used. They are used in the livestock show industry, also a completely different conversation. But I think that's the challenge, is urine concentrations don't correlate well with tissue concentrations, with meat or muscle concentrations. And so I don't know what to do with a negative or a positive test in urine. It's challenging to know what that really means.
That makes sense. I guess I could see how people would get there, because from my pharmacology training thus far, kidney is one of those target tissues that we'll sometimes be evaluating along with liver and muscle. So I could see how you could get to urine from kidney, but it's important to remember that the kidney's job is to produce this ultrafiltrate called urine, which is probably going to have higher concentration than what's happening in the rest of the tissue. Is that fair? Okay. So then I guess my big question is, what happens if my client does have a positive test for a drug residue in meat or milk? Am I just going to get brought before the board? Are they taking my license away? Or is my client going to lose their animals? What happens?
Yeah, it's going to depend on, you know, whether it's meat or milk. So if there's a positive milk sample, then that tanker full of milk is going to be destroyed. And so it will never enter the food supply. What happens to the producer of that milk, though, depends very much on where they're selling their milk, or if it's the first time or the third time that that's happened. So, you know, if it's the first time and upon investigation of what happened, it turns out that a mistake was made, a record was not recorded properly, or something along those lines, then it's likely that the creamery or processor might just say, you know, don't do that again. And you're on a, you know, we're paying attention to you, but, you know, it's all good. But if it happens multiple times, then there's certainly a chance that someone would stop, that processor would stop buying milk from you. So that's certainly a possibility. The same thing on the meat side. The USDA maintains a public list of producers who have had violations, that have had residues, positive residues, more than once in a 12-month rotating period. And so once you have violative residues multiple times, then it's, again, it's possible that they will not purchase your product anymore, your animals anymore, and so on. As far as what happens to the, or what could possibly happen to, in terms of penalties, again, if a producer presents animals that are unsafe, which is what we're talking about, multiple times, they will potentially get inspected by the FDA or the field office in their location. Their records will be inspected. And if there's a veterinarian of record for that farm, that veterinarian will be interviewed and also possibly inspected. And so it's not that one single violation triggers all of those things, because, you know, mistakes happen. And so that's not really the approach of FDA or FSIS, at least in my experience. But you want to prevent those things from happening. And you don't want to have them happen multiple times, because then you will get the hammer will drop and there will be inspections. You'll get letters from the FDA that say, you know, you violated all these things. And, you know, if you don't clean up your act, then we're going to shut you down, or we're going to prevent you from selling your animals ever again, and so on. So it's the pattern as opposed to the, you know, individual mistake or violation. So I think it's important that, you know, you stay vigilant. Nobody wants any of those things to happen. The other point to make here is that when there is a violation, like a residue shows up in meat or milk, for the general public, it's important to remember that if those tissues, if that meat or that milk is contaminated, it doesn't enter the food supply. So the system works when we identify residues, because the system is designed to find those residues and then eliminate those products from the food supply. So that's a point to make there.
A very important point at that. So what kind of resources are available for practitioners? I think of like small animal practitioners that are getting asked to see, you know, little hobby farms or potentially even, you know, bovine vets that are getting asked to see dairy goat type, like larger production setups. Everybody's goal is food safety. We want to keep the food supply safe. And so what are some good starting resources and maybe some good backups that people can have in their arsenal to make sure that we're all accomplishing this goal?
So I'll put in a plug for AASRP here, because the American Association of Small Ruminant Practitioners has fairly recently developed guidelines on about prudent drug use and about antibiotic stewardship, antimicrobial stewardship. So helping to prevent antibiotic resistance, mitigate its issue. So, I mean, I would start there if you're thinking about someone who is not familiar with small ruminants. What are the things you should be thinking about, particularly if you're not a if you don't have other food animals in your practice, I mean, you kind of are getting accustomed to working with animals that are food producing animals. But even if you're accustomed to working with food producing animals, there are, you know, some differences as it relates to small ruminants or smaller farms versus, you know, large dairies. There are some great quality assurance programs out there. You can search, you know, dairy goat quality assurance, and most extension, I've seen multiple extension services that will have some really useful guides to residue prevention, prudent use of drugs, things to remember about recording drug use, and all animal health events, and so on. So those are some places to start. ASRP also has continuing education sessions at multiple meetings. They partner with AABP, the American Association of Bovine Practitioners, to present sheep and goat and deer cervid CE continuing education at conference at their annual conference every year. There are often sheep and goat sessions at other conferences. ABMA has ASRP sessions as well. So those are other places too. I mean, your veterinarians are accustomed to doing continuing education. And so if you are moving into a new realm, if you're a small animal practitioner and you're starting to see some small ruminants in your practice, then those are good places to learn some new things about, or get some reminders about what's different about ruminants, what's different about goats, what's different about drugs used in food animals, and so on.
I think as a newer vet, having only graduated 5 years ago and didn't really have a lot of small ruminant experience coming out of school, but wound up doing predominantly small ruminants when I was in practice, one thing that I noticed is that my fellow goat and sheep veterinarians were incredibly welcoming. It was not, I was worried people would be like, oh no, we don't need more of you, or you're taking our job. No, there's plenty of work to go around, and people are so excited that other people want to work on small ruminants. So I hope that other practitioners out there are not intimidated by the community, because it's been very welcoming in my experience. So jump right in. All right. Well, I have a couple of little case scenarios here for you that might just help kind of put a lot of what we talked about today into a more clinical perspective for folks that are still listening thus far. So my first one is, what do I do if a client is asking me for oral chlorotetracycline for their goats? Can I do that?
Yeah, that's a good question. Extra label drug use regulations, federal regulations, say that drugs that are approved for feed additives cannot be used extra label. So drugs used in or on animal feed cannot be used extra label. And chlorotetracycline, the only way it's available is as a feed additive. So technically speaking, chlorotetracycline shouldn't be used in goats because it's not approved for them. However, there is a what's called a compliance policy guide from the FDA, which is a, kind of a special circumstances publication that says technically this is illegal, but as long as you follow some of these other guidance, and I don't want to go into all the details on that with this, but we can provide a reference for that as well about that you can, you could potentially prescribe. It's not really technically a prescription. It's a feed of a veterinary feed directive that you would provide for chlorotetracycline to be used. Part of it has to do with, you have to use the product that's as it's, formulated. It needs to be formulated for a similar animal. So if it's a cattle product, it could potentially be used for goats. The technicality is, though, that is still illegal. It's just of what's sometimes called low regulatory priority. And the FDA has said, we will not prosecute you for this illegal act as long as you follow these, you know, guidelines. And so it's kind of sort of a loophole in a sense, but it also is one that doesn't make it a legal use. It just makes it not likely to be prosecuted. So it's some people are uncomfortable with that. So one avenue is to not use that loophole. I hesitate to call it a loophole. That makes it sound hinky, but it's a reasonable thing to do, and people do it regularly. But that's the thing to understand about chlorotetracycline in particular, because it is a feed additive, that feed additives are in a different category. So we talked earlier about specific drugs that are illegal for extra label use. This is kind of a general category of drugs. So all feed additives no feed additive can be used in an extra label manner. The other drugs that shouldn't be used in extra label manner are drugs that are not for therapeutic purposes. So the extra label drug use laws apply to animals that are suffering or where suffering or death might occur if they aren't treated. So for therapeutic uses, production purposes, so like reproductive manipulation or feed efficiency types of uses, those drugs can't be used in an extra label manner, or drugs can't be used in an extra label manner to accomplish those things. So that's just a little going back to a little bit about what the regulations. So,
gotcha. That makes sense. And, you know, there's a whole nother discussion about whether oral antibiotics are even effective in ruminants. So aside from the legality, that would be a consideration as well. But basically, you might be able to do it, but there are a lot of other things to think about, and there's some hoops to jump through along the way. So it's a discussion to have, certainly. Okay, perfect. So my second scenario is, how about those pesky little goat kids that get diarrhea? Can I give them some metronidazole? I know that's really handy with puppies especially. So will that be okay if I do that?
So metronidazole is one of those that's on the list we talked about earlier, which is drugs that can't be used extra label in food producing animals. And there is no metronidazole approved for goats. And so this would definitely be an illegal use. So metronidazole would not be legal to use in cattle or goats or sheep or any other food producing animal, because there are no metronidazole products that are approved for any food producing animal in the United States.
All right. Hard no on the metronidazole. Got it. Perfect. Okay. The next scenario is, my client told me their go-to pink eye treatment is topical nitrofurazone powder. Is that okay, since it's not a parenteral use?
Yeah, and it's kind of a reasonable question, right? When I think about drug use, I think about giving drugs systemically, intramuscularly, intramammary, whatever. And if I'm just putting a little bit of drug topically, isn't that okay? And nitrofurazone would be another drug on the list of drugs that should never be used extra label. There is no approved nitrofurazone for food-producing animals. So nitrofurazone, no matter how you use it. So the regulation doesn't say systemic use, parenteral use. It says use. And so any use of those drugs that's extra label would be illegal. So this also would be a hard no.
Okay. I like the easy answer. Just no. So my last scenario is actually something that I saw in practice. I had a goat patient with a mastitis that cultured resistant to every intramammary antibiotic that we could find or that they could test for, but it was sensitive to fluorophenicol. And so my client did some research and said, well, there's a product for fluorophenicol in food producing animals. It's called Nuflor. Can we just infuse that into the udder, or could we give it systemically? So what would you say about that?
That's another great question. And there's a couple of things wrapped up in this question that maybe aren't just about legality that maybe might be helpful to think about. So the first is that the product Nuflor, and there probably will be other fluorophenicol generic products available, is approved for respiratory disease in cattle. And it is systemic. And the formulation of the product is designed for giving subcutaneously to animals. So the pH, the excipients, the additives, and so on that makes up that drug formulation are designed for a specific route of administration. When you give a drug by a different route of administration, especially like something that's such a major difference subcutaneously or intramuscularly versus intramammary, it becomes really challenging to predict what will happen to that formulation, to that drug, when you give it in the mammary gland. Is it going to be damaging? Are there some things in that product, not necessarily the drug, but the other things that are in the formulation that are potentially damaging to the udder, which is not what you want to do. You don't want to damage the milk making machine, right? Like that's probably not something you want to do. And so in the absence of really good scientific information that, that demonstrates that that product is safe and that you get concentrations of drug where you want them to be, I'd be very cautious about doing that. That's number one. Number two is in this, what I'm reading in this question is that you got a culture and susceptibility report. So you sent a sample of milk to the lab. They grew a bacterial organism and they did antimicrobial susceptibility testing on it. And the panel that they used might've been a mastitis panel. And most of the drugs on the mastitis panel are designed to demonstrate the effectiveness of the drug when it's given intramammary, not systemically. There's a lot more complication or a lot more details of that we don't really have time to get into. But I wouldn't be confident that if the susceptibility panel said it was susceptible to fluorophenicol in vitro, that that would actually correlate with successful outcome in my patient if I give the drug intramammary. So there's a lot of steps in between where I have a lack of information about correlation with the diagnostic results, as well as not knowing for sure about the formulation and whether it would actually be safe and also useful and provide effective drug concentrations. So there's a couple of things wrapped up in there. The as far as whether it's legal or not, I think, you know, if you have demonstrated resistance, then that seems like a reasonable rationale for using a drug extra label, because you can't use other drugs that are labeled because there's antibiotic resistance. But then you would also have to have information from FARAD that, or somewhere else where you would, have enough scientific information to provide an extended withdrawal time, because not only are you using a drug that's not labeled, you're also using a drug that's not labeled in a completely extra label manner, in a way that we might not be able to predict what happens to drug concentrations in the milk or in the meat, for that matter. How much gets absorbed? How much stays in the milk? How long does it stay in the milk? And so on. So there's kind of several aspects of that scenario that I like that really, you know, allows us to talk about a lot of different things, but it also is very complicated.
I mean, and my thought process was there's no goats on the label. It's not labeled for intramammary use, and we have no idea on a withdrawal. So we did not end up doing that. But it was an interesting question that came up. I think we ended up just drying that quarter off, decided not to mess with it anymore. So, but yeah, it can get pretty tricky, and there's a lot of convoluted ways to get to answers sometimes. But I hope that folks got a lot out of our discussion today. I think you had some really important points. And luckily, if they have, maybe this is a lot to take in at once, people can come back and listen to it a few times and certainly reach out to their nearest clinical pharmacologist or FARAD if they have further questions.
Absolutely.
Did you have any final thoughts for today? Or
no, I think we touched on some really important things. And, you know, we talked a little bit about, you know, thinking about, is the drug effective? We didn't talk very much about adverse effects, but that's always in every veterinarian thinks about what are the potential side effects of a drug, adverse effects of a drug, because I want it to be more effective than it is harmful. That's my goal, right? And then a lot about legality. Yeah, about legalities. And that it can get really complicated when you start layering in milk, meat, FSIS inspections, formulations, extra label drug use regulations that are federal. What's the veterinarian allowed to do because of the Practice Act in their particular state? Medical records, quality assurance. There's a lot of moving parts here, and so the conversation can get really complicated. So I appreciate the opportunity to talk about all of these things.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for your time. I hope we didn't intimidate folks, but if people have questions, they're certainly welcome to reach out at dairygoatextension@iastate.edu. That's our email address here. And we can get questions out to Dr. Fate if you have them specifically for her. But thank you so much for your time, Dr. Virginia Fate down at Texas A&M. And I'll look forward to seeing you this year at the annual conference. Mm-hmm.